The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
It has been quite the month, I want to say. About a
Almost.
Couple weeks. Yeah, it's been a couple weeks.
Like 2 weeks.
Yes.
But it feels like a month.
It do. It's been an interesting year for both of us.
Mm-hmm.
First time authors.
Mm-hmm.
We're both what we call ourselves label mates. We're still the same record label. We're at the same book publishing group, St. Martin's Press.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've known about this book for a minute.
Yeah, they don't hold anything.
No, they don't. And so when I had the opportunity to be a part of, I think I was getting ready to do my book. My book came out in February, as you all know. I was like, oh, you're next.
Mm-hmm.
And what a journey. Look, here we are.
Here we are in Philly.
Giving her a big, huge Philly welcome. You know, she's been everywhere. Already, she was in Baltimore yesterday. Boo! No joking.
Oh,
and she's in Massachusetts tomorrow. Definitely boo, right? You know, where those Patriots, whatever they play, they're not relevant anymore. But she's here in Philly, where it gets silly in Philly, and I'm happy that she has a really great, warm Philly welcome. So I'm super excited. But yeah, we're gonna have a really great talk. You know, I dressed up for the occasion. You know, the book, of course, is The Risk It Takes to Bloom, and so I wore bloom attire, you know?
You're
blooming. The dress fashion, really. She wore the bloom for Baltimore, but
ooh.
She's looking stylish. She's slaying it here.
You know,
listen.
I'm the risk and you're the bloom.
That's right. She is the risk today. I'm just blooming, yes, all the risk. Which brings me to this topic, the risk, you know? Before I start with that, how are you feeling? How do you feel? How do you feel right now?
I feel good. I feel really good. I feel just blessed and a lot of gratitude to be able to share my story on this level and have so many folks support. And I've been through the hard ones, you know, the hard tour stops. So, like, my family were the first two.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just wild to have, you know, these conversations about trauma and, like, my mom, my brother, my sister in the front row.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, this was gonna happen. I should have planned for this, but how can you plan for that?
Did they read the book in advance? Did you?
Well, allegedly.
Okay.
I mean, you know how it is. Like, people say they read it, and then you never know.
And then they start reading articles that show some highlights. They say, you said that?
Yeah, but everything that they were in, I read to them.
Okay.
So I read like whole chapters to my family throughout the process.
Yeah, I didn't do a memoir, but I talked a lot about cancellation. And so my parents, my folks were more worried about what I said about other people, you know, versus what I said about them, because I didn't really say much about them. I said, oh, they're good. I didn't do a memoir, so that's why I said that. But it was interesting, like, in that experience of, like, writing something sensitive in a very different way. So that's good. You're still doing how many more stops and things? You've been everywhere. Loren Cox, you know, Elliot Page, Ernest Owens. You know, she's been with some big heavy hitters. So proud of her.
Yeah, no, everyone brings their own flavor. This is stop 7, I think, 6 or 7.
And the book came out 2 weeks ago.
Yeah,
2 weeks ago. It's been two weeks and it's already been 7 stops.
Yeah. Yes. So we're going, and this is like halfway through.
She's giving Taylor Swift a run for her money on the tour.
Oh, Lord.
She's definitely doing it. The Swifties are here. The you know, the Raquelettes. The Raquelettes are here.
Oh,
jeez.
I can't.
I'm a Raquelette. I think
okay.
So. So, you know, you're on the good end of this, the blooming part of it. But from the beginning, what made you want to write a book? Like, I don't want to give the details about the book. I want to say, for starters, it's not the dramatic, traumatic memoirs that people expect. And that's what was very fascinating about it to me. I was very excited about when I read it, because so often books that are coming out by LGBTQIA authors, oftentimes it's slapping you with some hard, cold truth. I mean, look how beautiful the book cover is. You know, this could have been a different type of book. You know that. You know that. Look at this. So light, so pretty, and the color is just friendly. And it's some serious stuff here, right? Like a rose. It has its thorns, but it has petals, and it's soft. But some books, you know, a lot of books would be hard. And I didn't know. Because, when you know, nowadays, you know, they say, this trans author, this queer writer is telling their life. You're like, oh, my God, it's about to be a precious story. It's going to be a very depth. I'm going to be crying. I'm going to be emotional. And I'm going to go and feel depressed. This book does not do that.
There are some tearful parts.
But there are.
No, you're right. It is.
It's like Forrest Gump. There are moments in Forrest Gump that was very... Yeah, but you walk away feeling good about yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I think with this process, it was a chance to really be nuanced. You know, mm-hmm. like our stories as trans folks can't just be painted with one brush.
That's right.
And that has often been what has happened. You know, there are so few narratives of us talking about what it's like to be in the workplace, what it's like to navigate being in the middle of so many different movements, mm-hmm. right? Because that's also a thing, right?
Right?
We have all these little corners where we talk about, well, being a Black trans woman in the Black liberation spaces is a difficult journey.
It's like a genre almost.
Yeah, or in the LGBTQ plus movement, or in women's and feminist liberation spaces. So I feel blessed to be able to tell that piece of the story. And I'm just one person, right? So mm-hmm. I hope we have more and more narratives from trans folks that get to be nuanced. But I mean, we were talking about this before, right? It's so interesting to me that even after, you know, hundreds of pages of different insights on so many different things, there are still plenty of people who will just reduce me to my transness.
Yeah.
Or reduce me to their thoughts around my body,
mm-hmm.
What my body was like before, what my body is like now. It's so weird, the like continued cis obsession.
Those old horror interviews, but in current day.
Right.
Where it's like, we're still talking about it in that very like narrow
reductive
way. Yeah, mm-hmm. and it's so redundant. And I've seen some of the interviews you've done for this book, and it harkens back to like 5, 6, 7, 10 years ago, where those same questions. And it's like, did you actually read the book,
mm-hmm.
or did you just see that it said trans, and so you say, oh, I know this story already.
Right.
It's going to be another, you know, Caitlyn Jenner, Diane Sawyer interview type of thing.
Oh,
that's going to be a book. And it's just going to be that type of...
Yeah.
Nobody's
experience in our community is like Caitlyn's.
No.
Period.
No, but you know that the cishets, that's what they do.
They do.
They do it with us as Black people. Like,
yeah.
We see movies, they say, okay, you would think that Black history started in 1960s with the Civil Rights Movement,
mm-hmm.
or slavery, and then you just... That's all. We don't have anything in between. There's no Harlem Renaissance. There's nothing else.
Come on, Harlem Renaissance.
It's not right. Yeah. I would love to see a mini series about the Harlem Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we got so many other...
There aren't enough dogs.
There's not. There's nothing about the Harlem Renaissance. It would be so fun. There'd be so great actors. I think I'm a period, you know, I could get into that. Like a young Langston, maybe?
I think you could do that,
I could do that. But like, we don't have that. We don't, you know, we, to your point about nuance, we don't, various marginalized communities, there is always like one carving. And so it was a really good point you made, that the wave of writing that I'm seeing is coming out from trans voices, that's coming from just the particular movement space,
mm-hmm.
or sex work, but nothing else.
Yeah.
That's mainstream. I mean.
Well, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, the interesting thing is I actually don't really know many other narratives that are from movement space, right? Especially as a Black trans woman who came into my identity just before the visibility era. So that's also a thing. But I think also someone who has been in the midst of like the movement for Black Lives, right? And been on the ground with those folks doing community organizing and been in the midst of LGBTQ and specifically trans organizing.
Right.
Like so much work happens in our communities and we have so many leaders. And I yeah. think what there is always going to be a sense of urgency as a Black person, as a woman, as a queer person, as a trans person to share our stories if you're a writer or invested in storytelling, because we just have so few of those. And I do have to be honest. I mean, so much of what has given me life throughout my career has been learning about particularly like Black trans history,
right?
Learning about, you know, Frances Thompson and Mary Jones in the 1800s, right? Because we're often told, you know, and you know this, especially in Black community, but writ large, like queer and trans people are a new phenomenon.
We're finally getting a Bear Rustin biopic
right.
in 2023.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's been a gross amount of MLK biopics. Some done well and some not.
Yeah.
Just keeping it 100. But yeah. we have that scarcity,
mm-hmm.
you know, and that leads to erasure and a lot of other things. But one of the things that I know you worked in the journalism space with Out Magazine. Mm-hmm. I was at G Philly before I transitioned in other places. And in covering the community, I know one of the things, you know, T-Dor just passed. A lot of times when we do have these conversations around trans people, it's oftentimes centered around trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Your book isn't centered around trauma. Trauma is a part of the story, but it's not the story.
Right.
How did you navigate that in writing and structuring the book? Because it could, like, there's parts that you could have just stayed there, and that could have been the whole book. But you did a really great, I call it peaks and valleys. There were parts where there was some deep stuff that's just real.
Mm-hmm.
But then you also never was meek about the successes and the great moments and things that transitioned. And even where you're at now, like, you're not hiding that. You're not being meek about it. You're embracing it. You're stepping into your greatness. And that, you know, that's inspiration. That's really, you know, was refreshing. How did you find that balance in writing the book?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to that point, you know, and we were also talking about this before this, but the interesting experience for me now to have this work out is the way that people project their own experiences onto my story.
Listen.
So folks who have a particular relationship to trauma will read the story of my relationship with my family not as one of a family that evolved alongside
right,
me, which
right.
is what I have been communicating,
yes, I saw, yeah.
but one of like, oh, well, why can your family be better? And it's like, well, in what society, right? I mean, our society gives none of us tools to understand queerness or transness. And
right.
through the writing process, I was able to figure out how to give grace to other folks, not just my family,
mm-hmm.
but to other folks and also to myself.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And some of that grace came through because as a Black trans woman who came into her identity right before the visibility era, we were told to run away from our histories,
mm-hmm.
right? So like the little kid that was being raised as a boy that is a part of me, I had to essentially shroud, you know, and hide away because I was in a society that often weaponized that history
oh, yeah.
against
yeah.
me, right? And chipped away at my womanhood. So there's a lot of grace that has come through that writing process. But I think on the other side, you know, those tragic moments, I wanted to share that having lost my father when I was 19, which when you read the book, if you haven't yet, it is essentially a big catalyst for me to understand my transness.
Mm-hmm.
I learned through that mourning and grieving process how to integrate, you know, that tragedy, learn something from it, and move into a new space, right? Allow it to seep into my pores and reconfigure things.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that we're all going to have to figure out how to do because we're all experiencing different levels of tragedy all the time, especially in a time where, you know, so much information is thrown at us, right? So, for instance, we're mourning, you know, we had T-Dor, right? Mourning
yeah.
you know, over 30 at least trans folks, mostly black and brown trans women, murdered this year in the United States, over 300 globally that we know of. That's mourning, right? But we can't stay in that mourning space. We have to be activated and try and build a world that doesn't happen as much. And I think on a similar tip, I mean, when I think about the genocide of Palestinians, right, for instance, that is also something where we have to move from this place of the trauma, right, into something else, right? And I'll also say, I mean, when I think about, of course, the trauma that Israelis are experiencing right now and Jewish folks are experiencing now, we're also seeing how our trauma can be weaponized, not to necessarily make the world a better place, but to actually continue to be destructive in a way. So how do we do something different from that, right? So there's a lot of levels on there for me when I think about us moving from tragedy into activation. Mm-hmm. And I hope that folks can glean some of that from my personal experiences in the book.
Yeah. And one of the things that I thought about when you talked about grace throughout the book, which was mm-hmm. interesting, which also made me feel like the book was progressive in how it was moving beyond just a conversation, just sticking and residing in trauma. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes I read a lot of memoirs and it's like there's a hurt and they reside in that hurt. And then, you know, you're just left with that.
Yeah.
Versus here, there's that evolution. And one of the things that stood to me is that, you know, there's often these stereotypes and narratives like, oh, homophobia in the black community is worse than other communities. And I often hate that because I think that the way you explained it was like, where were the resources and education? Mm-hmm. And who was actually creating those laws? Because we wasn't in Congress creating all those laws. We weren't the Westboro Baptist Church.
Yeah.
Some of us grew up in a Baptist church. I grew up Pentecostal, but another story, another book. Mm-hmm. But like, that wasn't, you know, we talk of the way that have taken in a lot of rhetoric about our communities, our parents, and other people read and, like you said, project. You knew your family better than anyone else could.
Right.
And you explained it in a way where you recognize the things that were deliberate and the things that was, you know, unconscious, right? Mm-hmm. And I really did admire that, like those tough conversations, because they resonate with me in my life. And, you know, people don't know what they don't know.
Right.
And sometimes it takes those interactions to break down and have conversation. How did you explore that? And how did those conversations with your family progress after the book came out, while you was in the writing process? Like, what was that whole experience like?
Jeez. Well, I guess I'll start with my father. I mean, the interesting thing about my relationship with my father, so my father was a very traditional Southern black man, you know, all of these expectations around masculinity that he had for me. Yeah. Which wasn't atypical, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that is a very typical experience. But, you know, the interesting thing about writing, how I came to kind of understand that I could still love him and respect him and also chart my own path outside of his expectations, that was difficult because he's not here for me to talk to about it, right? So there's always going to be a piece of me that is like, curious about, well, would he have been able to evolve with the rest of my family? I don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, my mom likes to say, yeah, you know. One of my friends told me when she was at the launch event, I was talking with Elliot Page about my trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Weird. And we were saying something, and apparently my mom whispered to this friend and was like, he would have been right here with me, cheering her on. And so, you know, I'll let her be the writer of that story because that's beautiful.
Yeah.
But I don't know that, right? And that's something that will always be something I'll have to work through throughout my life. So mm-hmm. that is interesting. With my mom, because there are moments where my mom didn't necessarily show up maybe in the ways I would have liked, right? Or even the ways that I would have deserved.
Mm-hmm.
So I came out to my mom first.
How old was you?
I was 14.
Right. Yeah.
And trying to get somebody on my side before we had to tell my dad.
Mm-hmm.
And At first, she was like very understanding and wanting to like figure it out. But she swore me to secrecy that I wouldn't come out to my dad until I graduated from high school.
Right.
Because she was like, it's going to tear up our house and all of this. And it did kind of. So she was kind of right. But I wasn't satisfied with that. And so I went back to her and was like, I need to tell dad I need to come out of school. I'm sick of being asked all this stuff. Like, because, honey, everybody else see it.
Yeah, the town was talking.
The town was talking. So, but in the moment where I told my dad, my mom wasn't quite as understanding as she was at first. And it was one of those moments. I mean, this is really her story to tell, but it was one of those moments where I perceived my understanding mother giving more energy to this kind of like duty to, you know, her husband in this kind of like patriarchal way.
Right.
Obviously now being more mature, I'm like, okay, it's a bit more nuanced than that.
Right.
But at that time, that was all I saw. And so us having that conversation helped me understand the grace that I needed for that moment.
Right.
And she also understood, having read my account of this, how hurtful that moment was for me, the betrayal I felt in that moment where I came out to my dad. So that was the thing. I mean, we can go on, you know, and talk about my brother, because that's a whole nother thing.
They need to buy the book.
Y'all get that.
Buy the book.
When you read the book, yes.
One of the also things I thought was interesting about the book, especially in a memoir sense, is you talked a lot about intimacy and relationships and dating. And it was just different because oftentimes, I think it was different. I think for people who I know who've read the book, they said the one thing they appreciated was that it was the conversation around dating, they had not considered all of those things or saw it, because a lot of times they get it off of what they see on Pose and Empire and a couple of little shows.
And Zeus.
What's wrong with Zeus? Zeus ain't
if you
same.
Don't know what Zeus is,
that's okay.
Congratulations.
It's all right. I wasn't doing that tonight. We're trying to keep it on. That's another conversation. Zeus will prove to you that representation is not always. Be careful what you ask for, because you might well get it, right? We want more of us on TV. Yeah. How do we? Now I ask the question, how? Because less could sometimes be more.
Not quantity, but also
quality. Yes. I'll take, we were talking about David Makes Man, good show.
That was such a
good show with queer representation. I will take about three of those before I have like 5 or 10.
Whatever. Yeah, we probably can't even say the name.
No, I don't want to promote it. No free. This is gonna be a podcast too. This is a whole episode, yes. So they don't get free promo. But yes, Zeus, as in we're referring to Hercules. We're not referring to a cable streaming network. But that's right.
Cable streaming.
Ray J is a producer of the show, just to let you all know. He's a stakeholder. Let's just start there. He's a stakeholder, and so that's all you should know. But that being said, like, you do talk about dating in a way that isn't, you either have, and a lot of times when you have LGBTQ memoirs, the dating life thing is either I find Prince Charming and go away.
Child.
That's some people have that story. It's not as boring as they make it seem. But then there's people who do the I'm gonna date people, and it's hard, and I don't have any love, and I'm just alone, I'm asexual, which there's no judgment there. But it's either the range of no love or too much love. You find a way to have fun, and I thought that was the most interesting aspect of the nuances of that. Can you talk a little bit about that? I want to give all the details them, but share some of that if you can.
It's so funny. I mean, when I was thinking about how to write about love, it really wasn't as much about the specific relationships as it was about validation.
Right.
And desire.
Yes.
And the way that, as a Black trans woman, I'm indoctrinated with this idea, just like everyone else in our society, that we don't deserve those things, or that those things are not something that we should seek out. Yeah. And that comes up a lot. So I was very interested in trying to tell those things, those stories, and discuss those topics without feeling like it had to be packaged up in a bow. Because I think there's often this idea, and this can be for all types of women,
right,
really, in particular.
Agree, yeah.
This idea that, like, okay, well, is it worth talking about love and romance and the desire for those things if you don't have that perfect ultimate relationship at the end of the story? You know, I think it is.
Yeah.
Because that is often not people's story, right? Or people do get, you know, the Prince Charming, and then it's like he turned back into the frog after, you know, some time. So anyway.
You know, or like them Zeus situation ships.
Right, yeah. So I was curious about that. But I was fortunate to talk about two of my earliest relationships,
mm-hmm.
because we also don't have a lot of discussion about T for T relationships. And so my first two relationships were with trans masculine folks. And so I wanted to tell of that story.
No, that's a good point. I didn't want to overshare, because, you know, you need to buy the book. And this is not a supplemental alternative to the book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a precursor, it's a preview. But to that point, though, that is you said it, so I can go a little bit more. We don't see in literature a lot of conversations around trans and trans dating. It's mm-hmm. oftentimes a trans person with a cis person. I mean, I think about Janet Mock's book, you know, a lot of times those are the stories, and it kind of, you know, it's like the fairy tale ending. And that's no shade, like, but that typically how we hear about it. There's a conclusion or something to it, and then that's it. But
yeah.
This was open ended, and I kind of found that fun.
Well, I want to say, I mean, of course, everyone's experience is different,
right.
And I think thanks to Janet, and you know, people like Laverne, and people like Carmen Carrera and Gina Rosero, I think some of the trans women who came kind of like immediately after, and I guess including myself, we have more space to color outside of the lines.
Yeah.
Right. At the times that particularly Janet was writing,
mm-hmm.
I mean, Janet just blew the, nobody is ever going to touch what Janet has done.
No.
Ever.
Yeah.
In the time that she did it, where there was, it wasn't really a visibility era yet. Like, we weren't calling it that.
No.
And so she really opened so many doors. I saw myself in her writing. And so that comparison piece for me, I think, unfortunately, you know, we have to think about the context of, like, what stories can even penetrate at a particular time. And I think right now, even for cis, I mean, we've never had this many, like, cis folks complaining about each other and dating. So,
oh, the straights are fighting.
So I felt like I had permission to complain as a black trans woman in a different way, because cis people can't stand each other.
I mean,
right,
they're
now
arguing about Red Lobster and Olive Garden.
Okay,
and
$200 dates.
And I'm just like,
and
you know,
who, you know, it's just
wanted like, one, just wanted one person to respond to the DM. You know?
Right.
Just wanted one person to say yes, pass one.
And it, you know, so it's interesting. So. I wanted to talk about, you know, how formative those T for T relationships were.
Mm-hmm.
Not because they were perfect, because they had their own issues, right? But
that's what I've heard.
What was beautiful about those early relationships was that I got more permission to be myself in a way than I ever probably would have been able to. Than I ever would have been able to do in a cis relationship.
Cis
man or woman would have been able to build me up around my womanhood and my transness
mm-hmm.
in the ways that those trans masculine folks did.
That
felt important to tell, even with all of the difficulties. So that was a thing. But I think also I talk about, after kind of having those serious relationships and dating and what it was like to have the desire to want to date, you know, cishet men, right?
Like, and, oh, the trade.
And
I'm getting the trade.
Well, I won't say the trade. because that is, that's a particular type of group.
Okay, true. I had to let Trey alone.
And particularly at that time, I think the kind of validation and desire I was seeking was somebody completely unattached to trans community.
Gotcha.
Right? Like, because there was a different, I think, kind of desire and validation that I wanted to experience. And I felt like, okay, maybe some of those things that weren't quite perfect in those earlier relationships, maybe I could find that in this, like, more normative experience. And so I wanted to be honest about that, right? Like, I think that we often go through spells where we're seeking validation in different ways.
Yeah.
Whether it is problematic or nuanced or messy or whatever. And then I also talk about later on experiencing sexual violation.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
You know, at the hands of a man who didn't necessarily know that I was trans, but somebody had told him that I was at a bar.
And it was like an infatuation.
And then that became a whole moment of violence. So we delve into that, and it was interesting there because I wanted to make an intervention around how we talk about sexual violence, and we don't often talk about how trans folks mm-hmm. experience sexual violence from cis folks in particular.
100%.
So, so I wanted to tell some different stories around relationship and validation.
No, 100%. And my last question before we open up to the audience.
I know, we got real deep.
Yeah, it was, yes.
Thank y'all for hanging
rich,
with us.
Rich conversation. but my last question is just the book in general, just the impact. So you talk a lot about visibility, and in the book, there's themes around this conversation around, like, while there is high visibility, there is the tokenism and everything that comes with that. Now that this book is coming, it's almost like there should be an extension because now the life that this is going to have since, you know, we wrote the book, but now this experience is going to take a life of its own and going to open more doors and eyes to who you are and who you and everything. What is the advice you give to other trans people, even those who may be non-binary as well, about this visibility? Because there seems to be, as a journalist, I've covered the community for years in different ways, and there's always been this desire to be seen and get media attention. And I've seen people who've gotten media attention and it helped amplify them and they went off to do great things, but then I've seen people get a lot of media attention and it just increased the pressure and the dangers and the in circumstances. So as somebody who's been on the other side, the upside of it, mm-hmm. what advice do you give to people that feel like now more than they want visibility, they want media attention, they want to go out there and be seen? What is some of the advice that you would give those individuals?
Well, I think the desire to be seen is universal. I think so many folks see the opportunity to be seen in success in, you know, their career. I think they see it in, of course, social media, you know, and so many different tools. But I think what I'm so glad I learned early was that it's more fulfilling and rich to be seen by your own and by your own people.
Yes.
Than to be seen necessarily by the outsiders or the general public, you know, because to be seen is just one part, but to be seen and to be held, to be cherished, that's different. And so although I wrote this book and so many different types of people will read it, cis people are not centered in this book and are not centered in my story. They're not centered in my life. And be okay with that, right? Just in the ways that I have not been as a trans person centered in cis people's conception of our society. And the same thing, you know, white people are not centered in my story and in my life.
I couldn't find any in there. It was so
and
hard.
So there's some in there.
There's a few.
Yeah.
A few.
There's some partners.
There's a little bit of diversity there. There's some representation.
But I think that it's important, especially for folks on the margins, to be able to say that. Okay. And I give so much love to people like Toni Morrison, who really instilled this idea, and James Baldwin, right?
Yeah.
Instilled this idea into so many of our thinkers that it's okay for us to center our experience And it doesn't always have to be about a reaction to something else.
Yeah.
Like, I'm talking about systems of oppression, but I don't exist as a reaction to those systems of oppression.
So true.
You know?
Yeah. No, I feel that so much. Yeah.
And I'm existing and thriving in spite of those systems of oppression.
Yeah, like,
and I'm invested in dismantling them so that the next folks don't have to check off as many boxes as I felt like I had.
Yeah, but
to.
Your whole purpose in the work that people like us do is not a counter act.
Yeah.
And I think that that's one of the big takeaways I got from the book, but just when I think about my life, is like, it's not a response. If it do what it do, it's going to do what it's going to do. But the reality was, I didn't do it because of them. I did it for me.
Right.
And I think people lose sight of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like that was something that was heavy in the book, was it's like you were proactively seeking truth from various people in your life, whether it was, you know, trans or cis, you was going and navigating through for your own self, mm-hmm. for your fulfillment to get to this point to technically bloom.
Yeah.
That wasn't something that was like, oh, I'm just, you know, I'm going to be my best self to piss my dad off, or I'm going to be,
not.
But there's, you know, that's always a storyline for some people.
Yeah.
It's like, they want to avenge the haters, the doubters, or this, the that. I want to prove this person wrong.
Mm-mm.
It wasn't that. And I think people think that if you're not doing it for that, then is there any purpose? And your story in the book proves that.
I hope so. And I mean, this isn't the blooming to me necessarily,
yeah.
right? Like, it's a blooming.
Yes.
But, you know, I help also folks understand that blooming is something that we do continuously out throughout our lives. Right.
right?
And we have to recognize those moments where we have the opportunity to do that and be ready to seize them.
Yeah,
be ready to take the risk to seize them. You know?
I look at it like a book, like an editing like process. Like, you always, as a journalist, editor, you're writing and you're revising, and you're like, okay, this is the final draft. But then you look back 5 years later and say, oh, I could do this to it now. But it's like a self editing process. So I look at my life as a journalist. I'm like, I'm forever editing and revising. The final draft is never there. There's always more to revise and a chapter to pick up or a section to do differently through time.
Yeah.
And I think the process.
You do that with your life story. You're constantly evolving.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So let's ask questions to the audience. Okay. But before we do, thank you, Raquel.
Thank you.
And my Oprah mode. And this book can be purchased right after the speaking events. You can get your copies at bookstores everywhere.
As a woman whose identity is at many intersections,
mm-hmm.
do you feel like there was anything that you couldn't put in the book because of those identities?
Wow.
Oh, that's juicy.
That is a big question.
We're starting off real spicy.
Anything I thought I couldn't put in the book because of my identities. Ugh. I don't think so. I think I was pretty brave. I don't know. I'm trying to think what.
There was no relationships that you left out?
Relationships I left out.
Any celebrities? Anybody?
Oh, Lord.
Not gossip.
No.
Okay.
No
tea for the tea, you know?
I can't. No, I can't really think of anything.
That's a good question,
But maybe it'll come to me later, right? Mm-hmm. So maybe that's a good feeling. I don't have any regrets. And I know that's not quite what you were saying, but no, I think I was able to lay it out.
Love that.
Yeah. Yes. Thank you.
That's good.
Yeah.
So that's this is why I said it's very thick. This is a very thick book.
She's thick.
It's dense.
You know.
True.
Southern girl.
Let me see.
Georgia
over
Beach.
300 pages.
She eats.
Bigger than the first Harry Potter
Rice
book.
Rice and cabbage.
True. It's a very thick book.
From this experience alone, I feel like I'm learning just by listening to just the talk this evening about your experience and about the experiences of people like you.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel that you have maybe an overwhelming pressure to educate with all of these talks that you're doing and with the release of your book?
To educate? No. I try not to take that on anymore.
Good.
You know, and I think that is one of the...
Unless the check is nice, I will still educate.
Well...
I will still educate.
I mean, I'll educate, folks.
Give me your rate.
If I'm, I'll give you my rate. Coin. Let's talk.
Yes.
But I think in general, I've relinquished that burden, right? Mm-hmm. Because if people want to be receptive to learning, then they can do that. I can't twist their arm.
That's right.
And that's one of the benefits, I think, of being able to tell this story, you know, now, like a decade into my career. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, also a lot of folks that we know who have written memoirs, you know, wrote about experiences that were pretty recent. And I don't know how they did that. I don't know. And because that's a different type of pressure. So I feel the benefit of, like,
you had
a bit of remove from especially the most personal parts of my life.
Oh, yes, you're right. So, like, they're talking about recent experience in the moment for the book. Other books.
Oh.
No, what you're saying. No, I'm saying I agree with you. Like,
yeah.
What I'm getting here, what to be clear, is that there have been some authors who've written books that their traumatic experiences literally happened like a year or 2 years ago, mm-hmm. and then they're turning it into a book at a quick turnaround. And that process, like, for her, it was very clear. Like, she lived through it. She had she came to some summation of it in some way that she can put it there. But some people, you're like, I don't know. To
like,
your point.
Did you fully process it?
Yeah, and that's why I feel like it. When I was saying earlier about the trauma, it's like you're stopped there. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to move past because they're still in that process.
Right.
And for some people, writing the book is a therapy.
Which personally, and that was some. It was still some of that, but
for you, but not too much.
It wasn't. I did get a new therapist too during the process. So well, that's shout good. Out to my therapist.
That's good.
Yeah. And that helped for the next book. So,
well, thank you both for being here. You both look fabulous, by the way.
Thank you.
I gasped when you walked on stage.
Oh.
So I've seen a lot of people talk about, like, with Taylor Swift, Barbie, the Renaissance tour, even like talking about this summer of girlhood. Is there certain ways that you feel like you've been able to experience it and sort of reclaim girlhood in a way for you at all?
Wow. You know, I think. So there's a couple of things here. Mm-hmm. I think the reclaiming of girlhood, that comes when I'm with the dolls, you know, so like all the like glorious, like black trans women in particular, but just trans women in films. And even, you know, sometimes my little queer brothers, you know.
You mean Butch Queens?
Get in on it. The who?
Butch Queens. BQs.
The BQs. Yeah, but some of that girlhood does come back, right? Or I get to experience in a way that I didn't get to experience it the first time.
Yeah.
So that happens, yes. And I think there are definitely like moments with like my mom or my sister now that's like, you know, like my sister and I are going to like concerts and stuff together. And there's just like a different space in our relationship now. Also that I'm older, because my sister is 12 years older. So it's also that she also was always at a different life stage. And so I think now things have kind of leveled out a little bit because I'm like over 30. So that's the thing. But then the other piece is through the process of writing this book was an opportunity to reclaim, or not necessarily reclaim, but like to claim a boyhood experience that I had, right? And not feel like talking about those things chips away at my womanhood. Because I think for a long time, I felt like I didn't want to talk too much about, you know, my younger years because people might look at me differently or be like, see, you're not really a woman because you're talking about, you know, being raised as a boy in this particular way. And this process allowed me to relinquish that bullshit too.
Yeah.
You know, because if someone wants to challenge my womanhood, honey, jokes on them. You know, and people have a lot of energy online that they do not have in person because in person.
Oh, I know. Honey, I know. I can relate.
In person, it's very, they feel the goddess.
They get those
they
Twitter
respect
fingers.
The goddess. They see the goddess. There's no issue.
They get those Twitter fingers.
They do.
They get those Twitter mm-hmm. fingers. I've had a couple of situations where I was like, it's interesting. You had a lot on Facebook, but
in life,
face
yeah.
world, face to face, it's not the same.
Right.
The face card never declines.
It doesn't.
No.
I really admired how strong you came out for Palestine so quickly and the recent escalation at a time when you were releasing a book.
Yes.
And recognize there's like a huge, or likely a huge cost that comes with that sort of public stance. And it made me wonder how you've navigated, like, in general, in this capitalist culture, there's like a lot of energy that I imagine you're supposed to put into brand building, mm-hmm. your platform, curating sort of yourself for, to build an audience, both like for the message you want to get out, but also to like, you know, for your career. And so like those are often, there's like a competition between those two drives. And I'm just wondering how you have like carried yourself and shared your values and like your convictions alongside that need and pressure to like build a platform and brand.
Wow. That's some real shit.
It is.
Wow. Thank you for that question. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a dance for all of us, yeah. you know, and I think what was important about some of the other pieces I write about in the book around capitalism,
yes.
Around working in corporate media,
mm-hmm.
And on, it is a dance, I think, for all of us. And as someone who's known as an activist, right, and often put on this like pedestal, and there's this expectation that I'm always going to inspire, honey. I'm always going to help you believe in your power.
That's right.
Or that I'm always going to have the right thing to say, or that there are no struggles, you know, behind this head of hair.
Right.
But I'm a human, right? And I actually want to write more about that kind of piece, right? Mm-hmm. The way that some of us are branded as like vessels for other people to be liberated.
Oh my God.
And how limiting that is.
Mm. Mm.
But to your point, I can't lie and say there weren't some early moments where I was like, okay, well, how do I talk about what's happening to our people, right? To Palestinian folks. And of course, everything that's happening surrounding, particularly Islamophobia, right? And anti-Brown sentiment that is not being discussed by our media.
Right.
Yeah. Which is not to discount that we can have conversations and should have conversations about anti-Semitism, but there's definitely a disparity between the stories that we're hearing about from tentpole media organizations and the ones that we're not, right? The ones that it's on everyday people getting those stories out, right? And trying to be fearless and people losing jobs and on
the case for cancel culture.
The case for cancel culture by Ernest Owens.
Yes. I wrote about this.
Right. Yeah. Wrote about this. So yeah. It was there were some moments of difficulty, but I think for me, in all of my work, and this is the benefit of coming from a space of community organizing,
yeah.
is that my center and my accountability is with the people that I've organized with, right?
Right?
And so, you know, I've organized, of course, with other trans folks, queer folks, Black trans women in particular, sex workers, folks who were incarcerated, other abolitionists. And I've organized with Palestinian folks, right? And brown folks and Muslim folks and Jewish folks, right? So when I'm talking about Free Palestine, I'm saying that as someone who's a part of this sprawling community of folks. So I've been to rallies. You know, I went with Jewish Voices for Peace, you know, to a big rally at the Statue of Liberty, which was really powerful. I went to a Muslim-led action in D.C., and then I went out with Blacks for Palestine and BK. So for me, I think what we have to figure out is, like, I've been just saying that there's a community of folks with big hearts around the world, right? But I think it's really just a group of empathetic folks, and your identity and your background shouldn't keep you from aligning with that group of folks whose value is empathy. And for me, it was necessary because I needed to show up for my comrades, excuse me, who have shown up for me time and time again. I mean, I literally have had voice messages that I was sending where I'm like crying and being that girl that so many folks have been to me. That's like, child, I'm the one in the firestorm. Why are you crying? But you know, this mm-hmm. was an opportunity, I think, for me as a Black trans woman to be like, I'm present here. My shit is going on, but my shit is connected to your shit. So how can I show up too? Because I got enough power for the both of us as well. So I don't know if that hits directly at what you're saying, but I think we all have to figure out where our accountability lies and who our accountability is lies within. And use that as a center, and that has helped me throughout my career.
Yeah, and I think, yeah. you know, to a lot of what you're saying, I think about, you know, my career, like the stuff I spoke about on racism, this and third, and people say, oh, what about this? I'm like, well, I can't be concerned about people who didn't invest in my career to begin with. Mm. The same white supremacist structures and folks that are straight folks that now are worried about me speaking on different things. I'm like, but you wasn't invested in helping me. You wasn't shooting me in the gym to get to where I'm at today. Mm-hmm. But now you're telling me to consider all of the opinions of people who never gave a fuck about me.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of what you're saying. But like, I think it's in the sense of like, you're like, okay, when you were getting to your ground, you remember the people that was there with you. There were people that looked like you, people that came from your background. Mm-hmm. And then as you begin to climb up these different opportunities, then people want you to kind of lose sight of those people that were there for you.
Yeah.
To consider everyone else who still don't
right,
care for you.
Right, they want your allegiance to right. change and to then, the power structure.
Right, and then they're like yeah. the fear. But for me, I'm like, well, technically, I didn't come from a silver spoon. I didn't come from shit. So if I was to not have the things I didn't have, I know what that looks like already.
Yeah.
So it's not like, oh my goodness, like, oh, what does it be like? I'm like, well, it would be where it was before. This is a cherry on a cake of ice cream. I mean,
right.
we're talking about sacrifice,
wait,
you know?
Somebody else said that too. I feel like it was like Taraji or Mary J. Blige. Somebody yeah, was like, it was some amazing Black woman who was like, I know what the how to hustle.
Yeah,
you I know, because I've been there before.
Yeah, I feel like for me, that's how I would personally feel. Like, I would feel like, you know, people said all the time, I'm like, oh, you represent, like, well, when you started here, it's only, you've already know what that looks like. So anything uh-huh. that's up or up is a step progress for me.
Yeah.
But it's also the reality is that the things that sustain you from the right side of history, the people that sustain you to get to where you are will be the people that sustain you if things go weird.
Right.
Oftentimes. I'm a little bit more optimistic. And so.
Well, and yeah. I want to add, I mean, I think the other thing too is there's something about us having to constantly reject the frame that we're given about anything, right? Mm-hmm. So just as I, as a Black trans woman, has had to reject the frames that society gave me around how to think about my Blackness
mm-hmm.
and my queerness and my transness and my womanhood, I also have to understand that I've been fed and indoctrinated with thoughts and ideas about other people too.
Right.
Right. And so I'm constantly invested in how we can chip away at the narratives that were handed to us, because we know that those narratives were often handed to us from the folks who didn't mean us well, just as what you were right. saying, you know? So I'm invested in doing that work, even if it's not like immediate for mm-hmm. me, if it's not exactly my experience, that doesn't mean that I just brush off that responsibility.
Right. Piggybacking on what you just said, it's kind mm-hmm. of a two-part question. Speaking as someone who grew up in a religious household, I feel like we as Black queer folks always get told things like anything outside of straightness is for other groups and mm-hmm. not really for us. So one, if you had to deal with any of that, how did you navigate that? And the second part of that would be, have you ever felt like you had to downplay one part of your identity in order to enhance another, or have you always been able to have all of your identities coexist?
Wow. Yeah, I know.
The final question. The fierce question.
Yeah, I mean, to start with the first part, you know, the interesting thing about my relationship to religion is that although I grew up in a religious family, I grew up in a Catholic family.
Oh my goodness.
So my earliest experiences with religion and the church was being very aware that, like, we were in a mostly white context. Mm-hmm. And most of our extended Black Southern family was, like, Baptist or mm-hmm. Pentecostal yes. or AME or something else, right? So I was acutely aware. I was like, something ain't right. Like, how we get up in here with all these folks that yeah. most, like, we mostly don't look like, right?
Did you do communion?
Oh, I did the whole not. Okay. Oh. This was something we didn't get to. My family was devoutly Catholic.
Yes.
And when I say devoutly Catholic, I mean sat in the front pew every Sunday. And we had a sizable church. And my parents were my confirmation teachers, like together as a duo.
Yeah.
That's how involved in the church they were. My mom was so invested in the church that she won an award for her service from our bishop. And we had to drive from Augusta to Savannah, which is like 3 to 4 hours,
right,
for her to get that award. So when I tell you we were Catholic and the pressure for me to be anything other than the heathen I was, like how hard it was to just be myself.
You could have been a priest.
I could have been a priest. There was actually one priest who was like, I see something in you.
And it wasn't that.
It was not that. Yeah, it was not that. But yikes. Traveling priest. He was not like a regular, you know.
Clearly, clearly.
not the trade. Anyway, so, so yeah, so I mean, but I think to your point, it is important for us to have these spaces where we can talk about how queerness and nonconformity is actually inherently a part of the Black experience.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's one thing I really want cishet Black folks to understand is, like, you're trying to come after Black, queer, and trans folks, but, like, baby, you're never going to be man enough to outman a white man,
right,
or woman enough to outwoman a white woman,
right,
and you're inherently gender nonconforming, especially in this white supremacist society too.
Right.
So get that grip. But to take it to the other side, I think even for white folks, it's important for y'all to understand that, like, y'all will never meet these ideals around gender either.
Nope.
And so there's a way that we are all some kind of gender nonconforming. And the sooner that we realize that, I think the sooner we can figure out some of these other problems that we allegedly have with each other.
Well, what about their leaders? You know, Harry Styles and, you know, their leaders. Their leaders. I'm worried about the community. The community, the white community is experiencing a lot of changes.
They are.
And it's a lot of things impacting. I think about their leaders. Harry Styles, when you see him on TV,
mm-hmm.
it's the other ones they have, but the you see this, the way they dress,
yeah,
that type of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering how the white community going to respond to that.
If only they would.
They got to respond. I'm waiting for them to respond.
Yeah.
The black community has to respond to the things that
right,
they
have
do.
To respond to
I
everything.
Just want to see what they have to say about Harry Styles.
Yeah.
Important issue.
But I think to a point you made earlier, it's also interesting, too, because there's so many dimensions to this conversation around talking about queerness and transness
right.
within the black community, because outside of the community, you know, we always heard that, like, black folks are, you know, more homophobic than white folks. And then it's like, well, who is making your laws, honey?
Right,
and who are the ones exporting Christian doctrine to black majority countries to turn them against black, queer, and trans?
I just want to know that under a black president, we got marriage equality. Under a black president, we got marriage equality.
Okay, see.
I mean, there's more that could have been done. I know. I know. I read your book. I'm not giving him that credit. I'm just saying that. It happened under a black president.
Okay.
It
is a fact.
What a coincidence. It could be a coincidence.
Was it a transformative fact for a lot of folks? No.
No. Well, the White House was rainbow.
Okay. I can't. And your other question Can you repeat it really quick? I'm sorry, because I lost it. And
oh, no, I know what it is.
Go
what
for it.
What was, have you ever felt like you've had to adjust or change to adapt your identity? So, like, you know, I'm black, I'm queer. And white, when I was covering gay pride racism, mm-hmm. I remember being like, there were people that were black and queer that were like not talking about race so they can assimilate with the white gays.
Yeah.
Not the gays, the gays.
Well, very both.
That. Or both.
Really
the
both.
Gays and yeah. the gays. You're right. Or how Oprah would say it, the gays or the gays.
Yes.
But the other side to that point, to that same coin for you as someone who's trans.
Mm-hmm. Wait, I'm trans?
I didn't even, no. You know, I'm not going to do that. That's, you're right. But, you know, you know, in different facets, right? You're yeah. dealing with race, you're dealing with gender, you're dealing with, you know, this space in the community. Mm-hmm. Did you feel like at certain points that you had to code switch or do things differently in order to get some level of acceptance or assimilation in one space or another?
Oh, absolutely. I still have to deal with that, right? Yeah. I mean, I think it's important for me as someone who's visible, you know, a black trans woman who's visible, like, I still have moments where I'm like, let me not talk too loud because then maybe my voice will be too deep or maybe they'll think this or that, right? You know, it's been a mind fuck this year to record 2 podcasts and an audiobook and know that that's going out to the world. And I'm like, y'all, I have dysphoria around my voice often.
Really?
Still, yeah. That doesn't ever completely go away. Yeah. But I moved through it because, honey, look, you know, we're blooming. So somewhere along the way, it became okay. But that's real. I mean, I think being able to talk about dysphoria and insecurities is real. So definitely, I mean, I think to your point, there are times where I don't feel like I can fully own my transness necessarily, depending on the strangers I might be around, right?
For safety. Or,
yeah, it might be a safety thing. But I think also going back to, there are a bunch of moments in the book like that, but growing up, even in that period before I came into my transness, and I was like, okay, I guess I'm gonna have to, you know, I'm this gay boy now and I'm out. There were all of these things about not being too feminine, mm-hmm. right? Which I think a lot of, you know, my gay brethren experience, where they're like, oh, I don't want to be that kind of gay.
No, I have to be this way. I have to talk this way.
Right.
You know, Raquel, you're making a very great point. I cannot do this any other way. I'm not that kind of gay. I am the masculine.
Come on.
Center top.
Come on. I cannot. Yes. Okay. A moderate verse. We got it. So yes. So those experiences. I talk about being stealth in my first job as a newspaper reporter in Georgia. I mean, that's probably the banner experience of code switching because it's like I couldn't be too black.
Yep.
Because I was trying to hold down a job.
Broadcast.
I definitely couldn't be out as trans or queer.
Yeah.
You know, look, I had the perm, honey. With the horrible ends and, you know, it was all types of things because this was not even that long ago, y'all. This was like 10 to 12 years ago. The natural hair movement was not really a thing.
No.
It was not the trans visibility era.
No.
And then there was not this kind of space for even us as black people who are in journalism to just talk to each other and crack jokes on a podcast that's going to be distributed to, I don't know, a bunch of folks.
Right.
And in this kind of audience, like this is a different world.
It is.
Than where you come from.
That's right.
So
we're going to conclude at that and we're going to sign books. But last but not least, please give a wonderful applause to our esteemed author, Raquel Willis.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can join us in the main center, the main hall of the library. We'll be at the front. She'll take pictures with people, take selfies maybe?
No.
No photos. She's
of
not taking
course.
Any photos. Listen, don't play because the girl. So, well, listen, Kaya out here charging $15 for photos. No. But
You know, but it is funny to me that people are like, oh my God, you know, thank you for coming. And I'm like, thank you for having me.
And thank
like,
you for buying the book.
Buying
right?
the book and yeah. supporting. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So
thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.